Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program information and to reserve tickets for upcoming events. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for this evening's program. Today we are very pleased to have Mark Leibovich, New York Times Magazine Chief National Correspondent and author of the new book, This Town, and he will be in conversation with California's Lieutenant Governor, Gavin Newsom. Let me briefly say a bit about each. Perhaps no one has spilled the inside dirt on Washington, D.C. the way Mark Leibovich does in his new book, This Town. Sounds like many of you have read the book with that laugh. It is said that what Julia Phillips did for Hollywood and Michael Lewis did for Wall Street, Mark Leibovich does for our nation's capital. As chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, Mr. Leibovich is indeed based in Washington, where in 2011 he received a National Magazine Award for his profile of Politico's Mike Allen and the changing media culture of Washington. Mr. Leibovich was previously a national political correspondent in the Times Washington Bureau. He has also worked at the Washington Post, the San Jose Mercury News, and the Boston Phoenix. Mr. Leibovich's interlocutor today is California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who by Washington standards is definitely not an insider. Now, Lieutenant Governor Newsom... Lieutenant Governor Newsom, presumably with a political future in front of him, may have something to say about that. Right, Gavin? Gavin Newsom was elected as California's 49th Lieutenant Governor in 2010 and, of course, also previously served as two-term mayor of our great city of San Francisco, where it could be said he may be the ultimate insider. So please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Mark Leibovich in conversation with Gavin Newsom.
All right. Thank you, sir. Well, thank you, everybody. I bet one or two of you know why you're here. Rare has a book generated this much intense commentary, critique, celebratory, emotional outbursts, or just people had shrugged and said, come on, we already knew all this. So your life was going very well. Fancy title and a fancy magazine and a fancy position. You're part of the club. These are a lot of people, your friends. I mean, what were you thinking? How dare you?
Because it's an important book to be written. My wife was saying, I'm glad someone's writing this book. I just wish it weren't you. This is a book that I guess is a case study in forced discomfort. Like you said, I am part of this world. I work for a major news organization. I write about these people. I know them. And look, I mean, a lot of the people are in the media. I mean, I go after the media. And one part of the critique that you alluded to has been in the vein of how dare he?
Right.
How dare someone give away the secret handshake? And what I wanted to do was really piece together and sort of flesh out exactly what this carnival has become in Washington, D.C. over the last 5 years. And look, if it makes people uncomfortable, I sort of welcome it, and I think the Washington media should be more uncomfortable.
Was it your intent to expose individuals or, as I've heard you reflect, a more cinematic overview of a system that in many ways degeniuses people, meaning people with capacity, with originality, people that are well-meaning, that get in, find themselves stuck in a system where all of that originality is taken away and they become part of it?
Yes, that is perfectly put, in that this is a profile of a machine. I mean, I don't like to sing, people love to, especially in Washington, they love to say, well, he really went after X and Y right. and Z, and this person wins, and this person loses, and this person gets off okay. In a sense, this is a book about what the system does to people. This is about, I mean, people are complicated. People are not black and white. People have very gray motives, you know, demons. I mean, people come from different places.
Right.
I wanted to really flesh out and give a sense of maybe the suffocation of the power of what has grown up in Washington over the last few decades.
And let's talk about that, because I think the biggest takeaway that I have from the book and from your commentary around the book was the fact that D.C. used to be a place. I'm taking your word for it, because right. I'm not convinced of it, but or know enough to even have an objective sense of it. But it used to be a place for public service, and it's now been replaced by self-service.
Right. No, that is precisely right. I mean, this was a city built on people coming to do good. This was a city built on taxpayer money, subsidized by taxpayer money. There is now so much money in the political class. And by political class, I mean not just the growth of government in Washington, but corporate interests, lobbying, media interest in D.C. I mean, all kinds of money being spent on people who supposedly can help you understand Washington. It has become a place where people go to get rich. Again, that has really turned the ethic of public service v. self-service on its head.
And do you think, I mean, the people you're talking about, are they the consulting class? Are they the persuasion industry, as some have mm-hmm. described, lobbyists and consultants, as they now call themselves, not lobbyists? Or is it the politicians themselves that have come there?
It's all part of the same maw. I mean, there's this term I use in there, and I attribute it to Tom Coburn, who's a conservative Republican yeah. from Oklahoma, which is the permanent feudal class of Washington, D.C., which is really, it takes from everything you just mentioned. I mean, certainly the lobbyists, the formers, people who are formerly in office, people who are still in office, the journalists are as big a part of this as they ever have been. And again, it looks at the whole machine. And this is, I mean, once you are seen as an insider, I mean, the distinction between insider and outsider in Washington is, in a sense, much more important than Democrat and Republican at this mm-hmm. point. Because if you are seen as an insider, that is your value proposition.
So you make a point in the book that we're not as divided Washington, as it appears. In fact, in many ways,
hopelessly interconnected.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that's absolutely true. And I think what people need to realize is, first of all, a lot of these people who are fighting on TV are actually scheming in the green room and going into business together, starting lobbying firms, going on the road, doing yeah. these dog and pony debate shows and so forth. This is a system that rewards itself in part based on what doesn't get done. Right. If a tax reform bill passes tomorrow, that is tens of billions of dollars in lobbying fees and consulting fees that are not going to be paid out. Shouting matches that are not going to be conducted on your evening cable show. So, look, I mean, Washington works very, very well for Washington when things are not getting done.
When you talk about a former, as a former mayor, I'm sensitive. When you talk about a former, what do you mean by a former?
It's a former office holder. It is a person who has been in office. Usually, what the founders intended was for people to come to Washington, serve a term or two, go back to the farm, reintegrate themselves into their community, and just sort of serve for a time. I mean, now, you know, 50% of all senators, when they leave office, remain in Washington and become lobbyists. That figure was 3% in 1974. So
just repeat that, because I mean, and it wasn't 15, 50%,
50,
one
50,
half
of
all senators.
They stay in Washington to lobby many of the same people that they just served side by side with. And 42% of congressmen do the same, again, compared to 3% in 1974. So, again, I mean, the swamp that they're campaigning against is often the warm bath that they settle into once they're in Washington, right? And again, you can ask them why, and probably the first reason is going to be this is where the money is. I mean, this is where I'm going to get paid. I mean, in Trent Lott's case, who's a former Senate Majority Leader, he was telling me how much he hates Washington, and he's sitting in his big office on, I guess it's on M Street, not K Street, but spiritually it's on K Street. I said, so why do you stay? He goes, well, Washington's where all the problem is, but more to the point, this is where all the money is. And Trent Lott, I think, was probably clearing about $5-6 million last year. He's in business with John Bro, who's a Democratic senator from Louisiana, former Democratic senator from Louisiana. These are two formers who went into business together, have done very, very well.
And when you come across these senators, congressional leaders, and we'll get to their staff, which is, I think, exposes even a bigger problem. It's because it's less obvious. It's less, right. It's easier to example people whose brands we know. But is there any self-reflection about this? Is there any shame?
That is such a on-point question. You have no idea. I mean, I think I would like to think so. I mean, I would love to say who I'm talking about now, but I'll just make it anonymous. I got a email.
Why would you start that? You've written about
these are specific examples, but this is a private email I received within the last couple of weeks from one of these specific examples. They do not come off well in the book. Their ilk doesn't come off well in the book. I saw his name in the email incoming thing, and I said, okay, I'm going to get chewed out here. And it was an incredibly humble, soul-searchy kind of email saying, that book reminded me of the old mirror that I have in my bottom drawer that I take out occasionally that exposes all of the things that I don't really want to see about my face. And it was a very, very valuable experience, and I hope you'll write a sequel.
That includes this email. Right,
it makes it look better. Then he probably went to Bank of America and got a new deal for $1 million. No, I mean, I don't. There's actually been far more of that than I thought. And look, I mean, there is some outrage. I mean, I think one of the more interesting takeaways from this has been the disconnect between the reaction in D.C. and the reaction elsewhere. The reaction in D.C., especially in the media, has been the titter tatter, the gossip, the dish. And you
knew that.
I did.
I mean, you had to expect that.
I did. Look, I mean, and there was also a lot of anticipation around this, in part because of...
I read the book before it came out. I mean, Politico must have run 20 stories.
18.
Honestly, 18.
The Atlantic reported that they see the media is now reporting on the media about the book. Yeah. See, there has been premise-affirming stuff going on, like, every day. But, no, Politico, look, I mean, this is... I mean, one of the things that has been quite disappointing is I was hoping that more people in D.C. would have their back up in a way that would spark a debate about what I am fleshing out. I think what's been most illuminating has been people actually being outraged outside of town. I mean, people are saying, yes, I'm entertained, it's funny, but wow, it's depressing. And I had no idea, and I wish we could do something. And then they ask me, what can we do? And then I put on my cop-outy journalist hat. And
I'll give you that opportunity later.
Okay. Yeah. I have it perfectly well ducked.
I know, I've heard it.
Yeah, yeah.
I can actually, you can ask me the question.
What can we do?
Yeah, no, my job is to reflect the
mirror.
That's
perfect. I've become like the person I mock.
I'm running in circles a bit, but let me step back. We talked about politicians and that revolving door, but staff, that sort of entrenched group of folks that are really making decisions day in, day out, also have an eye on that same prize and monetizing that experience.
Yeah, it arguably a much bigger menace because we're talking, factors of 10, 20, 30 people. I mean, maybe you'll read about Senator Dorgan joining, wherever he's going, Hamburg and Quist, wherever, I mean, there you go. But no, for every one of them, I mean, there's 20 staffers on his committee in his office who is going to similar lobbying shops. I mean, maybe you'll read about it in a trade, but no one knows about it. But again, I mean, there's this, I mean, you wonder who they are working for, right? I mean, you wonder when they're in office, what friendships are they trying to maintain? Are they working on behalf of the constituents of, whoever, whatever state their boss is from or whatever the committee serves? Or do they have their eye on the next gig? Are they listening to the lobbyists who they're talking to every day about, keeping them happy?
So. Who were you trying to keep happy? Who'd you keep out of the book?
I would say I admittedly went easy on the New York Times. This is where I work. I've made a very cop-outy diplomatic decision that I didn't want to create discomfort in my workplace. I love my workplace. Who'd I keep out of the book? A lot of people. I mean, I focused on who I focused on. I mean, I guess if they were close friends, I probably kept them out. But I didn't, it wasn't a hard decision because I don't think I lost any real friends, and I don't think I would have.
You kept Lanny Davis out.
You know, he was very aggrieved by that. Lanny Davis is a classic Washington character.
I love this.
He is a crisis communications guy. He worked in the White House counsel's office during the Clinton impeachment days. He's a big-time Clinton loyalist. What people don't understand is that there is one White House counsel. The White House counsel has a staff of maybe 50 counsels or associate counsels. But if you work in the counsel's office, quite often when you go on cable, if you get to go on cable, people don't distinguish between whether you're the White House counsel or if you work in the counsel's office. So he was a counsel. So it's sort of like, I don't know. So Lanny Davis got famous by going on TV as the White House counsel, meaning he was one of 50. He was an impassioned defender of Bill Clinton. He became this crisis communications guy. Loves to see his name in print, and I would not give him the satisfaction of naming it in his book. And I got this email from him, faux thanking me for not including him, pretending to be relieved, but then saying, yeah, I kind of wish you would put me in. And by the way, here's a copy of my book, and I didn't name you either. And of course, I made a mistake of telling that story in one of my first interviews, and then he thanked me for that. And so then other people asked me about it. It's part of the derivative culture we're talking about, right? It just all spins on itself. Anyway, it's all been good for Lanny Davis's business of protecting third world dictators or whatever.
Which begs, in this case, you spared him in the book itself, but do you feel at times that you had to check yourself, that you had an axe to grind with some of the folks?
Probably. I think so. I mean, I think, well, first of all, on a humanitarian level, I don't want to cross a line from critical, acerbic, edgy to mean. I mean, I probably fail on some occasions. Yeah. I don't want to be mean. It's not who I am, but a lot of people, I'm sure, would disagree that I succeeded in that, or would say I didn't succeed in that in places. Did I pull punches? I mean, there have been a couple of reviews that say that, you know, because I'm an insider, because I want to keep my access, because I want to keep getting invited to these stupid parties, I wasn't as hard as I could have been. That's probably true, but look, I think by being an insider, I probably know a lot more than I would have if I had the luxury of being a foreign correspondent and just swooping in.
I mean, how is it for you having book parties now as an insider, reflecting on the insiders having book parties and the absurdity? It's sort of, the whole thing must be
It's been completely
bizarre.
Surreal. It's been a completely surreal summer. I mean, I can't complain. I mean, the book's been very well received. But there was a moment when Bill Press, a well-known sort of liberal. Is he from out here?
Yeah.
I guess he is.
Yeah.
He asked Jay Carney in the White House briefing, so, Jay, have you read Mark Leibovich's book? And this itself is surreal. And Jay said, well, no, but I'm sort of hoping I'll get invited to the book party. And because the White House doesn't come off terribly well here. I mean, no one individually has gotten that it's all over the map. Anyway, so I emailed Jay. I immediately said, look, you can come to the book party. And he emailed back and said, you've reduced me to groveling from the podium. So I thought that was a pretty funny line. Now, also, you know, it's a window into the chumminess that me and Jay have. I deal with Jay if I want to write about the White House, and I used to work with him. He was a former Time magazine correspondent. So, again, that's a window into my world. But, of course, my book party was covered by the Washington Post, by the Atlantic, by any number of august institutions, which, again, is part of the same absurdity. I mean, I've got a million stories like that. It's just been a weird... it's just been the circles of meta have strangled me here.
So how do you reflect on the critique that you disclosed that secret handshake? I mean, honestly, what about that? I mean, that you had these interactions, these conversations, you didn't have pen and paper out, there wasn't a recorder present, it was a casual cocktail party, people are being more open, more honest. That's important to have that openness and that honesty in a world where we're all focused on talking points and how we're perceived. And you're in the process of sort of putting all that together, aggregating it, and creating a narrative.
There's an important distinction here, and this is actually something I'm very, very, actually I would say quite defensive about, which is I don't violate private conversations. If I'm talking to someone at a party, it is a private conversation. I am not running around and saying, hey, look, so-and-so just told me this, and, you know, he thought it was private, then he's going to read about it in this book in 2 years. I mean, look, as a reporter, you enter into ground rules. I mean, sometimes, you know, things are off the record. Sometimes if people have the assumption that we're not in the middle of an interview, I'm going to honor that. So, I mean, that's as central to my job as anything, right? I mean, I need to be trusted. And so everything that we're talking about here is a public event. I mean, right. If you go to parties in D.C. now, book parties for people on TV, I mean, there are reporters there. There are video, I mean, Politico has like 3 videographers at some of these things. Yeah. Tim Russert's funeral, which a lot of people yelled at me for writing about because of the whole opening scene of the book. I mean, this is on live national television. It was written about in maybe 25 different publications the next day. I mean, because I focused on the jitterbugging in the aisles, I mean, I don't know, maybe that's a little unusual. I mean, I wasn't looking at the stage as closely as the TV cameras were. But no, I mean, look, I'm a journalist who abides by rules, and I mean, the secret handshake is that I guess that people inside are not supposed to speak critically about other people inside. And I guess that was an unwritten rule I violated, but that's okay, I'll do it again.
But you seem very proud of the fact you think journalism needs to be shaken up.
Totally.
And you also make the point that journalists, and I tend to agree, tend to be even more thin-skinned than politicians.
I do tend to agree. It's absolutely true. I mean, I don't like writing about the media. I mean, I think it's important because I think it's a much bigger part of the story than the media likes to think it is. I mean, the media loves to talk about itself. They love to write about each other's new contracts and new shows and new books and everything like that, new haircuts. But I mean, media criticism is one of the most perilous jobs. And I'm sure, you know, you've had interactions with reporters that, I mean, they are going to be so quick to get their backs up. But I mean, look, it's not a fun group to take down, but I think so many of them feel, I mean, there's a level of arrogance in the media that I think, look, and I'm sure the New York Times has been accused of it as much as any paper, but I think that it needs to be called out.
Interesting. So you brought up Tim Russert in the book. So I would say legendarily, though you just came out with this book. Let's call it legendary. Mm-hmm. There's a book written in 2013. But it begins with that. I mean, Tim Russert, most of you remember Tim Russert, but you can remind us of Tim Russert a few years back. This funeral, this where presidents were, Bruce Springsteen, I mean, the world was there lamenting the loss of one of the true giants, beloved figures. A real journalist in a world where we don't have much journalism. We now have people that sort of read teleprompters and regurgitate and aggregated blogs. You literally were inspired to do this at the funeral.
I was amazed as someone who was sitting there in the Kennedy Center. I mean, it's sort of striking that a big Washington sort of state funeral-like event would happen in the Kennedy Center for the performing arts. It sort of, says what you know. That's where the big funerals are in D.C., and people are falling all over themselves to try to get tickets to these things. And what I was struck by was here was this giant of a newsman just struck down in the prime of life and just became a cocktail party from the outset. You had people rushing up to Hillary Clinton trying to get her to go on Keith Olbermann's show that night. You had people rushing up to Joe and Mika trying to get booked on Morning Joe the next day. You had people sucking up to Robert Gibbs and David Axelrod trying to congratulate the soon-to-be Democratic nominee and, you know, maybe, you know, scoring an interview with Obama or getting a gig in the White House or something like that. I mean, people were working it, and I just thought it was particularly perverse that it would happen at such a somber event, and it just seemed like a very good jumping-off point. And also, I mean, to sort of set everything in history, this was the eve of this historic presidential campaign. You had these change brigades who were about to come into town around Obama.
Right.
Economy's about to crash. The Washington economy is not going to hiccup at all. And look, you had the beginning of Twitter, this was really the first campaign that was run entirely in the hyperspace of the netherworld of cyberspace. It was the first truly online campaign. And, you know, again, you started this anarchy in the peanut gallery at a time when the center, Tim Russert, sort of was taken away from the town. And I think that that he has not been replaced.
Yeah. Let's jump into Obama. You brought him up. Contemporary. You don't want to change the players. I remember hearing this over and over and over again during the campaign. We need to change the game. Has Obama successfully changed the game of Washington?
No, not for a second. I mean, I think there is this scene towards the end of the book in which the president convenes a weekly meeting. It was like in the end of 2011, in which he decides that his White House is not being coordinated well enough with his then-fledgling campaign in Chicago. So he brings everyone in every Saturday, and they just talk strategy. And at the first meeting, Obama says to everyone, look, I want to be open here. I want to try to reclaim what we had in 2008. I want to level with each other. It's a big group. We have about 15 people in here. I hope we are comfortable. I hope this will stay in here. And after about the fourth or fifth meeting, in one, the president begins one meeting by writing about five or six things that he wished he had been more vocal about in his first term. One was, you know, gay marriage, immigration, climate change. I mean, I think Gitmo was on there. Right. And sure enough, a few days later, Jim Messina, who was the campaign manager out in Chicago, gets a call from one of the Game Change authors saying, hey, what about this list that the president put together about what he hadn't done? And Messina calls the president. The president is pretty pissed. And can you say pissed to the Commonwealth? Anyway, sorry. Pretty ticked. Yeah. And the president leads off the next meeting by saying, look, I'm really disappointed. I trusted you guys. These have been great meetings. These have been some of the greatest meetings that we've had, and I hope they continue in some form. But if they do, it'll be without me. He walks out. Biden sort of chews out everyone for letting down the president. And then there's this big soul-searching meeting that sort of ensues in which, at the end, Robert Gibbs sort of says, guys, what happened to us? Did we change Washington, or did Washington change us? And I think that's a question that sort of runs through the entire narrative as far as, again, the power of this machine, even amidst the best of intentions, whatever their intentions were. I mean, I think that they were sincere in large part in 2008. I mean, I think they had a great, great message in 2008, it certainly worked. But I thought that was an important moment and also something that ran through a lot of the themes.
Were they naive from your perspective? Or did they not try hard enough and they just succumbed to the prevailing winds and said, look, we've got other things we've got to prioritize?
I think it's a huge job. I think the office itself, I mean, forget Washington itself. I mean, the office itself, I can imagine, can overwhelm even the most gifted of people. I mean, it's proven that time and time again. I don't know if they were naive because they all come from the political world. Most of them come from Washington. I mean, the whole, we're outsiders, we're pure because we work in Chicago, we're right on Michigan Avenue where the real America is. I mean, that thing got a little old for me. I mean, I think, you know, these are political professionals. They found a very, very compelling candidate. They had a really, really strong message. He delivered it, and that was that. I don't think they tried hard enough, to be perfectly honest with you, and that's the kind of journalistic thing I probably shouldn't say because it's opinionated, but yeah. I do wonder how hard they tried. I don't know how successful they would have been, you know, with the Republicans and on the Hill right now, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem like they put forth the effort they said.
And you specifically point out campaign finance, where they decided to relinquish or succumb to campaign finance rules, right. Super PACs in this last election, and lobbyists themselves that didn't have the capacity to meet directly, and they started waiving those rules, et cetera. Is that so? What I mean is, it just the fire hose of that reality that it's just too big to change? I mean, if someone like President Obama cannot change it, with all of his skills, all his power, with all the expectation, hope, and change that we all, even my most conservative friends at Choir, are like, well, maybe this guy is that good. Maybe this guy can change. Can it be changed in a broadest sense? How does this change?
I really hope so. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, look, I think the country is ripe for it. I think that if you look at the level of dissatisfaction, not just in poll numbers, but I mean, the willingness that both sides are willing to sort of reward an authentic candidate. I mean, if Herman Cain can come off as authentic to a segment of the Republican Party, I don't think that he or Michelle Bachmann or whoever is the answer here. But look, people are very hungry for someone who is not of that world. I mean, Barack Obama very convincingly convincingly sold himself as someone who was not of that world in 2008. I think they would say, and I know they would say this because I've asked them this, I mean, they've done some good. They've passed legislation. They've moved it forward. Sure. I mean, it's a huge boulder that they're just going to push up the hill. And obviously, the kind of the inspiration of a campaign makes you probably more hopeful than you should. It's a much easier environment than governing, I think. But look, I hope someone can do something.
Yeah. Reminds me of that wonderful, we're all quoting Lincoln. I'm a politician, so it was a great movie, so let me quote Lincoln. But all the politicians are. But he had a great line. He said, "We're all born originals, but we die copies." So it reminds me of the originality of campaigns, the sort of poetry of it, the enthusiasm and expectation. And then all of a sudden you get into office, and I mentioned the word before, but it is as if you get degenius, that the system just eats you alive. And I say that just to reflect now on sort of the next sort of segment of the conversation, getting into some of the individuals. You know, I sat here with Evan Bayh, introduced him many years ago at the Commonwealth Club. I was here on stage with former Senator Dodd. These are people that you exampled in the book that I always looked up to, that always were saying the right things. I'll never be a lobbyist. I'm different. And you example, in fact, you know, Senator Dodd is lobbying for the motion picture industry. Evan Bayh is doing more than just a little bit of lobbying here and there. I mean, What do you make of all that? Again, I'll give you my own subjective point of view. I don't think you were mean at all to any of these folks. I really don't, any of them. And even those that felt you were particularly hurtful, I didn't think it was mean. You sort of pulled back consistently. Mm-hmm. You weren't indicting those individuals necessarily. But how do you, I mean, what's your assessment? Is it just money at the end of the day? I mean, which is understandable. Is it? Yeah. What is it?
It is. I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I think money. First of all, I mean, I can't believe I'm defending this, but I mean, Chris Dodd would say legitimately that he was one of the poorer members of the Senate for 30 plus years. I mean, he worked in public service for 40 plus years. I mean, his father was a senator. He was not wealthy by senatorial standards, and he's got two young kids to raise, and he's entitled to make, you know, a seven-figure salary just like anyone, right? I mean, this is America. No, I mean, it's true. I mean, I'm allowed to be demoralized if he can sit across from me in the Senate dining room and say, "I will not lobby," and that turns out to be either a lie or his view evolving, whatever politicians say. But the term I use in the book is institutionalized. Yeah. They are institutionalized. This is a world they know. This is where their relationships are. Chris Dodd was talking to me when he was still in the Senate, and he was talking about retiring, about maybe going out to Silicon Valley and like joining a startup. And because he knew a lot of venture capitalists from his work, and he'd raised a lot of money out here. He talked about joining the Peace Corps, which he did at the beginning of his career. Very compelling guy. He's a hard guy to dislike.
Yep.
And then he just sort of, this became the path of least resistance. It was the money that was thrown in front of him. And I remember Bob Kerry, who was another former senator, he was up for the same job, and I remember him saying, "You know, I could never do it." But then they started throwing this money around, and I'll clean this up a little bit. It's fully unplugged in the book. But he said, "Then I really started giving a damn about piracy, and I sort of thought about the Motion Pictures Association, and at $1.3 million a year, I got really interested in piracy." But they're not bad people.
No.
I mean. And look, I've been to these rallies. Yeah. I've been to political rallies on both sides that I've just felt the magic of. I mean, I think you go to enough of these things, especially, you know, really charismatic politicians, and you want to believe in them.
Yeah.
And, you want them to do better. Maybe they just do their best. But, I mean, look, I mean, politicians can be very ambitious, and you can never be more ambitious than when they are campaigning. I mean, I remember, it's personal here, I mean, I interviewed Gavin a couple of years ago when he was mayor of San Francisco, and I did a big story for the Times magazine on the California governor's race. And my editor at the magazine at the time said, "You know, this is going to be the big story of 2010. You have the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, running. You have the mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, running. You have, you know, Dianne Feinstein might run. Jerry Brown might run. You know, Meg Whitman. I mean, you had this all-star cast." Turns out a lot of them fell by the wayside. We put Gavin on the cover under the headline, with the headline, "The Gavinator," was it?
Pick it. Sometimes you're right.
A couple months later, you got out. We could put Lieutenant Gavinator.
That was the end of my chances.
Yeah, anyway, in our infinite wisdom, you can look at
the cover of Sports Illustrated.
I hope you kept it. It's a great kept. Yeah. But no, I mean, I remember we were having these very speculative conversations because you weren't a candidate yet, but you were talking about orders of magnitude change in California, which was it was the actual language.
Yeah, still.
And look, it was a very ambitious and very compelling way of looking at at politics, especially vis-a-vis the problems of the state, especially in that moment. And I'd like to think that people are open to that. I think the electorate will prove time and again that they are open to it. The delivery system is majorly flawed.
So it's the old adage, you want to move the mass, you got to move the cheese. You got to change incentives. If you want to change behavior, you got to change incentives. Seems to me that your book, if nothing else, the narrative is the incentives are for bad behavior. And that our approval rating in D.C., politicians' approval rating may be, or outside of D.C., maybe 13-14%, but with the special interest and persuasion industry, it's probably 80 or 90%.
Right. Not to mention, I mean, speaking electorally, I mean, if Congress has a approval rating of 10%, I mean, how many of these people in the poll, how many of these people in the poll will say the same thing about their member of Congress? I mean,
right.
People like their member of Congress far more than they like the institution of Congress. But again, I mean, and they get into power and they can gerrymander their districts and they can sort of game it according to their system, according to their advantage. But also, I mean, status quo is going to be rewarded by them going along and getting along with their leadership. It'll help them raise money. It'll help them get committee posts. I mean, it all perpetuates itself quite nicely for them. So.
Well, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club, a California radio program. Our speaker today is Mark Leibovich, the New York Times Magazine chief national correspondent, who's discussing his reasonably controversial new book, This Town, about the inner workings of Washington. I'm Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. You can also find video of the Commonwealth Club on programs online at Fora TV. Let's get into more granular conversations about personalities, even though no one wants to hear about these individuals because they are...
We're far more
we're above that.
High-minded.
This may dull the senses. let's just throw some out. I mentioned Senator Dodd and former Senator Bayh. But let's talk about some of the heavyweights and perhaps the super heavyweight of influence and power seems to me as super lawyer Bob Barnett.
Bob Barnett is, in fact, a super lawyer. Now, how do you become a super lawyer? Do you go to a special law school? No. You get on TV a lot. You get your name mentioned in the press, so eventually you start getting named a super lawyer. Bob Barnett is a longtime veteran lawyer in Washington, D.C., represents Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, senators, congressmen, first ladies, Palins, Clintons, Obamas, whatever. I mean, he's basically the guy who is going to represent you if you want to in some way cash in your public service, whether in the form of a book deal or a lobbying deal or a TV gig or a speaking gig or something. Bob represents everyone, pretty much, including about 375 broadcast journalists. He calls himself the doorman to the revolving door.
I mean, he literally calls himself that.
He literally, proudly in speeches, he calls himself, which is like saying, hey, I'm the mayor of Tammany Hall. I mean, I never understood, like, I mean, he says it with a chuckle, and look, I think it's instructive that in this world where people can so easily cash in and leave office and write books and give speeches and get big jobs in which they are monetizing their government service. He has sort of created this one-stop shop to help people do that. Now, the Obama people were running in 2008 in part on a platform of closing the revolving door.
Yeah.
We are not going to be part of this Washington. They worked very, very hard to keep Bob Barnett out of their debate prep thing. Bob Barnett has a sort of a side gig in which he helps the Democratic nominee prepare for the debates. He's been helping the Clintons do that and for many, many years. The Obama people wanted no part of him.
Right.
He eventually got himself into the team, like a kind of a small position.
Which is a juicy part of the book, worthy enough of your
purchase.
Yes, chapter
two. Everyone read this. Anyway, he eventually gets on the team, and all the people who are trying to keep him off eventually sign on with him to do their books and their speaking and their consulting gigs. And sure enough, there's a scene at the end where he is now firmly ensconced in the Obama debate prep team at the end of the last campaign. And anyway, he is really, I mean, he is very, very much the nexus of cashing in. He does not represent me. I don't think he likes me very much right now.
Did you want to have him represent you?
No, I never did. And part of it because I couldn't write about him. And he's one of the great unwritten stories in Washington. If any journalists are watching this, someone should take it on. Because I just think that so much of the influence just runs through Bob.
You call him the super lawyer and a cash redemption center.
Yes, that's where a lot of people go. I mean, Bob is a classic example of someone who has made Washington work for him. I mean, a lot of the many profiles in this book are of people who you wouldn't necessarily have heard of, but who are people who probably have just come to Washington at a time when there is a lot of money and there's a lot of value put on what they do, and they can do quite well for themselves.
So how did you go about picking the characters? Were they just symbolic of the larger narrative?
Some. I mean, some of them were big fish. I mean, some of them are presidents and, you know, Clintons and, you know, some of them were, I think, they helped tell the bigger story. They're cogs in the machine. They're not necessarily household names. Some of them, I just think, were so completely representative of a Washington type. I mean, Richard Holbrooke, who's pretty well known, who died in 2010, he gets his own chapter and all the sort of pageantry around his death and the controversy that surrounded him. Let me ask you,
what did Richard represent in that context to you?
Richard was someone who was this classic kind of point of tension between the Clinton world and the Obama world.
Yeah.
Right. And he was this Clinton loyalist. He was utterly full of himself. He's a brilliant diplomat. He is a great self-mythologizer, completely full of himself. He was very much of the drama ilk of the Clinton world. The Clintons loved him. He loved the Clintons.
They would say the same thing about
They
Ambassador
totally
Holbrooke.
Would. No, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No. He's a handful, but they would say he's worth
he's
the trouble.
He's our handful. Yeah.
Right. He's our handful. Yeah. Actually, I think the language is a little soft
here.
Yeah,
trying to clean it up.
But handful. Obama never sort of bought him. His team never liked him. He was Hillary's pretty much deputy for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yep.
He basically collapsed in Hillary's office and died a few weeks later at the end of 2010. And I sort of unfurled the whole drama around his fight inside the Obama White House as a proxy for the Clinton battles of just the kind of not that far removed from the surface tensions between the two kind of camps.
Yeah.
So he's also a classic figure, I think.
Harry Reid. It's interesting. Why Harry Reid? Why'd you include Harry Reid?
I love Harry Reid. Harry Reid is I think I love him as a character. He is a unappreciated figure in Washington. He's arguably the Frank Underwood of Washington. Yeah. I mean, he gets things done.
Yeah.
He is a fixer. He has outsourced all of the sort of froth that the politicians in Washington sort of put value on. He doesn't care about getting on TV. He doesn't care about getting credit. He doesn't care about getting a plum, speaking time at the convention. He just wants to be in charge.
Right.
And he's shrewd, and he's totally bizarre, and he will say whatever. He's got this weird kind of Tourette's-y kind of thing where he'll just say stuff. He says like some weird stuff. And I just thought he was an unappreciated character and an incredible power center. And and for some reason he took a liking to me and he let me hang around with him for a few years. And he actually called me the other day and I said, are you mad at me, Senator? He said, if I was mad at you, you'd know it. He hung up.
Earpiece envy. Mm-hmm. What possibly could you be referring to?
There has been a lot of tension in administrations about who has Secret Service protection or security detail and who doesn't. Valerie Jarrett, one of the president's top aides, it was said that she had earpiece envy of David Axelrod because he had a security detail, partly because there were threats made against him in 2009. Valerie, according to many people in the White House, had earpiece envy and then went into the president's office, allegedly, and asked that he authorize a detail for her. And she still, to this day, has a pretty full complement of Secret Service agents around him. Do you have earpiece envy of anyone, Devin? Do you have earpieces cut following
you
around?
I need my people around.
All right.
Yeah. Make me feel like I'm somebody. But why do you include that? What is it about that? So of course, it's fun to read. I mean, you know,
it's fun to read.
Was that just to sell the book, or was that making a point about what's wrong with D.C.?
I don't think there's
people
any...
are after the wrong things. That what matters, what they value, is not what's important.
I think that I don't make any major value judgments around the phenomenon of earpiece envy. But I think that people are people are so status conscious in D.C.
Right.
They notice these things.
Yeah.
I want the entourage.
Exactly.
It helps to have a driver, I guess. You don't have to make restaurant reservations. You know, you get these people sort of clearing out the room for you. I mean, that's convenient, right? People sort of see you as a big deal. Didn't you have earpieces as mayor?
No, I did. That was the old job. The former.
You're the former.
But so why? I mean, you said two parties and a funeral, plus plenty of valet parking. What is that valet parking? You referenced it.
There's plenty of valet. Everything in Washington is valet parking.
What does that mean? Why is
every
that a
party
subtitle?
Invitation? It could be. It goes on too long, doesn't it? I actually had some.
It's a long subtitle.
It is. That way, but it's funny.
What are you communicating there? What are you trying to say?
Two parties, Democrat and Republican, and a funeral. They're sorts of play on two weddings and a funeral.
Right, yeah. All right.
Plenty of valet parking. That's me being cute because it talks about, you know, it gets to the notion of America's gilded capital. This is a very, very fat time to be living in Washington. There is valet parking everywhere. This is a city where people can live very, very large and do.
Haley Barbour, Terry McAuliffe. McAuliffe, potentially the next governor of Virginia. Barbour, the former governor of Mississippi.
Yep.
Why are they relevant?
They are both, I would say, class officers of the political class. I mean, they are former party chairmen. I mean, Haley Barbour, you know, longtime Republican National Committee Chair. McAuliffe, Democratic National Committee Chair. They met in green rooms. They used to yell at each other on TV all the time in the 90s or the early 2000s. They became friends. They're both, you know, they both love politics. They both love the theater of it. They became investors in a restaurant. They did favors for each other. There's all kinds of examples of things they did for each other. They just became friends, and now, you know, Haley Barbour became elected governor of Mississippi. He served two terms. He then got out. He and Terry, for a while, were doing paid debates together at various corporate retreats and so forth. And again, they are two big-time members of the political class. Although Terry is now a Washington outsider who is creating jobs for the people of Virginia, and
who got tax breaks for an investment
in Mississippi.
Yes. With his friend. Again, this is part of the campaign. I'm not passing judgment. But it's become a big part of the campaign with Cuccinelli.
It has. Yeah. It has. That and his car company, which has not done terribly well recently.
That's for others to judge.
Mm-hmm.
Friend Terry.
I should be saying that.
Hillary Clinton. Did you take her on this book? Was she relevant? You have an interesting point. You say Barack Obama won 2008 campaign. Hillary Clinton. I think you begin a chapter. Hillary Clinton. Won the first term.
Yeah, I mean, look, Hillary Clinton left Washington, essentially. I mean, she became Secretary of State. She became a citizen of the world. And at a time when Washington just kept dipping in public esteem, Hillary Clinton got to sort of absent herself from that. So I think she benefited greatly. I mean, I think the Clintons, and I think in politics in general, you benefit greatly from absence. You benefit greatly from people longing for you. I think she's been reluctant, or I think she's been publicly reluctant about her plans. I think that only helps. I think things will change pretty quickly once she starts behaving politically again.
Right.
If she ever stopped.
Right. You get into some interesting examples of people that we may not be so familiar with, but when you talk about a former, you use one particular example, Ken Duberstein. Who is he? And why, as a former, is he symbolic of your point of view?
Ken Duberstein served 6.5 months at the very end of the Reagan administration as Ronald Reagan's chief of staff. This is at the very end. I mean, this is not a very effective period of Ronald Reagan's presidency. I mean, people were focused on the next election, his post-Iran-Contra. He might have been, you know, slipping a little bit physically. And Ken Duberstein was sort of a caretaker chief of staff, and he has essentially been dining out as Ronald Reagan's former chief of staff for 25 years. He's been making, you know, which is fine. I mean, he's not a bad guy. I mean, he's made millions of dollars a year as a lobbyist. He is someone who goes on TV whenever there is something to say about Ronald Reagan. I've had many of my colleagues refer to him you know, God forbid, as a former Reagan administration official when quoting him, only to have him just call them and their editors and yelling at them for not properly referring to him as the former chief of staff, because, you know, he dined out on that, you know, your title is everything, and he has done very, he sits on pretty much every board in Washington, the Kennedy Center, this foundation, that foundation. I mean, look, he has taken advantage of a system that is in place. He is the quintessential former when you sort of look at actual service he put in for the job that he is always going to be known for versus the number of years he has dined out on it. So,
do you, and I'm, as I've asked these last few, I'm incorporating your questions and embellishing a few. Mm-hmm. But do you like Washington, D.C.? I mean, just personally. You have kids, you're raising a family there. Just on a personal basis, is it, or has it disgusted you?
Both. I mean, I think this is the part of the conversation where I utterly contradict myself. No, I mean, it is actually a very pleasant place to live. I mean, it's a very nice place to raise kids. We love our neighbors. I love my job. My wife loves her job. My kids love their friends. And that's sort of life, right? I would probably, if you could sort of take all of this and put it in a couple of other cities of my choice, I would probably like to do that. But this is where our life has transpired, and our families are in the Northeast. And look, it's worked out for us there. Are there things I would love to change about it? Absolutely. I think in Washington in particular, I think this is true of a few cities, but Washington in particular, you've got to choose your friends very carefully. I think you have to make sure that people want to be friends with you and not your job.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's true of anyone, even in a semi-public life or in any status-conscious environment. I'm the guy who, I guess, sort of burned down the village and yet continues to try to live there. So I don't know. It feels like a contradiction. It maybe sounds like a contradiction, but it's one that I think I can live with.
Yeah. You must have had, I mean, on a serious note, you must have really reflected on the impact of your career, your life, your family, ability to, you've got three young kids, their futures. I mean, you took a risk here.
I did.
With this book. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk just a little bit, I mean, without getting too much in the details, but what are the kitchen conversations at home with your wife? Did she warn against some of this? She say, you know, Mark, you don't need this. Things are going great. Why are you doing this?
It was
overdue.
She was really sick of this book. I mean, it took 3 years to do. It took a major toll on my family life. I mean, I'm not one of these writer fast kind of deal.
Right.
I mean, I had a day job. I wrote at night. I wrote on weekends. My kids are pretty young. It was a killer. And my wife was just terrific, but she, you know, she lost a lot of patience. I mean, I don't blame her. I was also, look, I mean, I go after some people. This is not a free and breezy book. I mean, this is a book that does take risks. And look, my nature can be somewhat neurotic. I mean, journalistically, I mean, you got to be right. I mean, a lot can go wrong in 375 pages. People are going to scrutinize you. People are going to fact check the hell out of you. I mean, there is this playbook by which people discredit Washington books. And the first thing they do is they send an intern or some junior staffer or something, and they just fact check everything. They find anything in like a gray area, whether it's, you know, maybe an imprecise job title or a number or something that might not be true but is sort of true, and they'll put the 10 bullet points together. Some blogger will pick it up. You put a headline on it saying riddled with errors. I mean, that's what the White House does when they have a book that they don't like.
Of course.
And you just, so, I mean, I hired a fact checker. I mean, I knew, I expected just this flood of incredible criticism, incredible pushback. Miraculously, it hasn't really happened.
Yeah.
Because I'm completely beyond reproach.
Because
I don't know why. I don't know if because I went after so many different sectors, there couldn't be an organized response from like the White House or from Senator X. But no, I mean, it was, my feeling is, look, I mean, risk-taking is the essence of what we do as journalists. I think it should be. I mean, I'm extremely afraid of being bored in my job and in my life. And I think, you know, I'm 47, 48 years old. I was 45 when I started this, 44 when I started this. And it's, Look, I just think that shaking things up is important, both personally but also professionally, and also as a culture. And if you're in a position to do that, and if you have access to a job that can help you do that, I think you almost owe it to yourself, or at least to some people, to try to do it.
A lot of questions about social media and how that may be playing a role, particularly as it relates to the journalistic aspects of Washington, D.C. You write a lot about Mike Allen. You, of course, infamously did a cover story in many ways.
Infamously.
Yeah. It was objective. Google it, and you'll see I'm right. wrote a piece about this figure, who was a Californian of birth, who is prolific and remarkably powerful. Your piece, I had never heard. How many of you have heard of Politico? So most of you.
Wow.
How many of you know Mike Allen? So those that are listening, everybody just raised their hand about Politico, but few people know about Mike Allen. He has something called the Playbook every morning. I never heard of this until you wrote that story. You should subscribe to this thing. First thing I read when I wake up, I can't believe this. I'm from California. Here I'm reading the Inside Washington Beltway. The reason I do it is because I'll know exactly what will be on TV subject by subject. I can literally script it based upon the power of this individual setting the tone and tenor for what quote-unquote matters. He curates the world and its news overnight and basically sets the tone and tenor for everything that you consume out of Washington, D.C. He is a pretty powerful person.
He is the most, I'd say, most influential and powerful journalist in Washington today, which I think is a sign of the times. But no, Mike, first of all, he has a particular genius in that he writes in this email exactly what you as a political consumer want to read.
Yeah.
I as a political consumer want to read. I mean, believe me, I have a hard time not reading him. I mean, you just keep scrolling down. He knows exactly what happened in the last 6 hours while you were sleeping.
Yeah.
He's read everything. I mean, it's an amazing skill.
Is.
And it served him very, very well in this medium, as opposed to the traditional journalism medium. And, you know, I worked with him for many years at the Washington Post. And he's also kind of a quirky character. He allegedly doesn't sleep. I mean, he keeps a very nocturnal figure, very, very private. But no, I mean, again, what you said, I mean, I think it's exactly what will be on TV. I mean, David Axelrod was saying that when he used to work at the White House, he had maybe a 7-minute commute from his apartment, and he had a car take him to the White House. And if he overslept or if he didn't have time to read the papers, which is true of many people these days, he knew that if he could get to that email in the 6-7 minute drive, he was going to be okay in that first round of meetings. I mean, and that's, look, I mean, this is not meant as an indictment of one of the most powerful men in the country at that point. I mean, this is emblematic of the sort of tip sheet mentality that the media has adopted, but also that consumers of the media have adopted and sort of require.
So as a consequence, I mean, social media, a blog, I mean, has that been participatory in this, degrading or deleterious atmosphere that's been created in the last decade or two?
I don't know. I mean, I think it has elevated standards of fame to a point where, I mean, I think entire books could be written about this. I mean, it's been a very democratizing, piece of the conversation. I mean, and I'm a consumer of Twitter. I mean, I probably...
Is it democratizing? But I've heard you say otherwise, that it's amplifying.
It is. It's both. It's democratizing, it's amplifying, and I also think it's amplified the self-absorption that has always been thus in D.C. I mean, I think, now instead of... I mean, it has allowed for the culture of insiders to become a much more sort of easily available snack food, right? I mean, anyone can sign on to Mike Allen. I mean, he has about 150,000 subscribers now. And they can be insiders. You too can be an insider just by reading this, or at least be the illusion of it. And you can get on TV. And does that make it democratizing? Sure, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's the world we live in. How's that for profound? It's the world we live in.
It's the world we live in.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You guys are all over them. We're in Syria. We're in Russia with some of the questions. I'll try to sort of bring some of these back. But I would be remiss. I have a friend who's in this book, Tammy, the Tam Cam. Why don't we just start there? What the heck is the Tam Cam?
Tammy Haddad is a longtime producer for Larry King. long time, she was a producer for Chris Matthews, for Hardball. She reinvented herself as a sort of all-purpose convener of the Washington A-list. One of the many parts of her public imprint is that she has this little camera that she brings with her and does these little ambush interviews with people, and she posts them on her website. Tammy is another example of someone who has made Washington work for her. I don't think she liked how she was portrayed, although
no.
I do like her personally, I think. And I don't think I'll be invited to her White House correspondence.
Well, let's talk about
brunch.
That. That's her big thing every year, right?
She has a big
brunch before the White House correspondence dinner, and it's the who's who of the who's who.
You ever been?
Don't take this as a segue, but I've been blessed to be invited the last few years. I'm not one of the who's who, but I've been, a number of times.
Yes. I don't think I'll be invited anymore.
You were not invited this year.
It's funny.
She claimed that she
actually, this is like in the period.
She'll have you next year for sure.
I don't know.
It's
funny. Larry King, actually, I was on Larry King's show the other day, and he wanted to talk all about the Tamster, and he said, send her my best. And then at the end of the interview, he said, I'm going to be in Washington next week. If I asked you to lunch at the Palm, would you say yes? And I said, yes, I would say yes.
Yeah.
So it hasn't happened yet. But I got to get back to town to have lunch with Larry. Now, look, Tammy is, a crude assessment might be, she's a social gatherer. She's a socialite. 40 years ago, socialites just sort of had parties, and they sort of got a kick out of seeing famous people in their house and whatever. Tammy has now built a very successful business out of it. She has contracted to a number of media companies. She has helped people get into the White House. She has helped people meet other people. I mean, it's a very, very valuable business proposition that a number of media organizations, probably chiefly Bloomberg now, has paid for and has made her very successful.
And, it's interesting. It's another segue, the Tam Cam from social media, Tammy to parties. And then a number of you who just seemingly can't resist but ask this question. There's four of you. Who throws the best parties in Washington, D.C.?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask now.
Which of you enjoyed the most?
Wow, this is a trap because I'm going to answer it and they're going to say, the guy who
tweet it out.
What parties are, I guess the big party, the one party I do go to every year is the New Yorker party on the Friday night before the White House correspondence dinner, which is always fun because I'm so high-minded, only the New Yorker is worthy of it. No, I don't know. No, this is the part where I kind of get all...
Yeah, you're hedging. What happened to your authenticity?
The Bloomberg Vanity Fair after party is always toughest ticket.
Tough to get in.
I mean, it's wall-to-wall, like people, like serious A-list, not people like me. So that's pretty good. But
what is the White House Correspondents' Dinner? And why does it even matter? And what did Bin Laden, President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and the White House Correspondents' Dinner all have in common?
Chapter 10. The White House Correspondents' Dinner used to be the sleepy annual banquet held at the end of every April at the Washington Hilton. Journalists, public officials mingle, tell a few jokes, and that's it. It is now metastasized into a festival of 5 days, pre-parties, after-parties, tens of millions of dollars spent on entertainment and food. It's a classic example of Washington's inability to sort of reflect and change and recognize how discordant they are with the rest of the country and how the rest of the country views it and what are they celebrating. Anyway, in 2011, the Bin Laden raid was scheduled for that weekend. And the very, very small group of people who knew about this on that Thursday were meeting in the Situation Room talking about when to do the raid. And someone mentioned Saturday night of that weekend. And it turned out to be the Sunday, but they first raised Saturday night, and someone said, well, the president's supposed to speak at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and if he doesn't show up or if they see all this commotion, the journalists are going to pick up on it, and word of the raid will leak out. And Hillary Clinton looks up, and this is, I'll clean this up also for the Commonwealth Club, although it is Hillary Clinton. Anyway, she looked up and she said, blank the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And I just thought that was a great... It was a good moment for Hillary, I think. I got that from a close aide to her, and I am sure that they were happy.
They were happy
now in the public space.
Yeah. And you say that just because priorities are straight.
That's what she was thinking. I mean, it turns out the raid was on Sunday, so the world became safer when bin Laden was killed. But more importantly, everyone in Washington had a great time that Saturday.
Everyone but Donald Trump, as I recall.
That was, I think, the same year, yeah.
Yeah, that was not so... Yeah, it was a tough one for the Trumps. Yeah. We're at that point in the program where they... tell me we have time for one more question. And I'm going to take an audience question because I don't have that fabulous final closing hit the ball out of the ballpark question, except the one that someone offered up, and that is, what question on this book tour, from your perspective, prompted your most sort of memorable response? What question that you've been asked as a relay? This was the question I'm receiving from the likes of you. I mean, what was, you know, what, and maybe, let me ask it in a different way. What are you ultimately trying to assert here that you think is lasting and meaningful? What do you, a year, is this a book, because it's so contemporary with so many of the individuals, that we'll forget a Robert, I mean, with respect to some of these folks, Lanny Davis, Robert Gibbs, these folks, you know, there'll be the whole new crop coming in the next administration. Is there something 4 or 5 years, what will be the lasting legacy of this book? Or what do you hope it will be?
I think what it is I'm not a historian. I don't have like the 20-page diversion in which I talk about the Gilded Age of the 18th century in Washington and the robber barons. This is not one of those thumbsucker books. I wanted to capture a moment. The moment I would define as the 21st century. I think these are figures who have been around for a long time and I think will be around for a long time. I do think that this is a gilded age in Washington. I think people don't fully recognize that. I think gilded ages come and go a few times a century, I guess. But I don't think people fully appreciated, have fully appreciated what this now all looks like. The full-on sort of examination of the decadence behind so much of the dissatisfaction that people in America hold for their capital city. So, look, if this can, this is where I sort of do the hold a mirror to a culture thing. But that's sort of, it's what I do. I mean, it's what I hope to do. I hope it's lasting. If it's a fun read, I can handle that too. But I have been gratified by, first of all, a lot of college students, a lot of political science professors, a lot of people who watch C-SPAN, who said that they hope that this will sit on library shelves for a long time and bookshelves for a long time. Hope they don't sit on bookshelves for too long. But that people will sort of look back and can actually look at to see what life in Washington was like in the early part of the 21st century.
Does this town exist in Albany? Does this town exist in Sacramento, California?
Probably, on a much smaller scale. Yeah, no, I mean, or on a different scale. No, I mean, I've gotten a lot of response from people who say, oh, I know people like that in Springfield or wherever. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you see a lot of this in Sacramento. So.
Yeah. Well, our thanks to Mark Leibovich, New York Times Magazine Chief National Correspondent so far. We'll see what happens to him when he gets back home.
Yeah.
The author of the new book, This Town. We also thank our audience here on radio, television, and on something called the Internet. We remind everyone here that Mark will be signing copies of This Town. And my 2 cents, I'm not just sucking up here. If you haven't read it, you have. Trust me. Pick it up. Spend the extra time in line. Get another glass of wine. Get him to sign the book. But take advantage of this opportunity to pick this book up. We appreciate all of you as well, allowing him to get to where he needs to go so you can get to where you need to go. So let him go first to get to his desk so he's ready to sign his books so that he can move on as we all can to the rest of the evening. I'm California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and now this meeting, my favorite part of the Commonwealth Club of California, place where you're in the know is adjourned. Thank you all.